Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times. In our most recent event, we were joined by Dr. Trezanne Kremer, the current director of the Institute of Criminal Justice and Security at the University of West Indies in Jamaica. In honor of Black History Month, we discussed the reasons behind a disparity in Black and minority students studying international relations as opposed to their white counterparts, as well as the experience of individuals from a small state working in the international arena and any bias that may entail. Welcome everybody to this episode of Grimshaw Speakers. You can tell by my voice that I'm somebody you're unfamiliar with and you haven't heard before. So my name is Kenya Lawrence and I'm a third year international relations and Chinese student here at LSE. And I'll be taking this segment of Grimshaw Speakers, which is in honor of Black History Month. Just a little bit about me, my ethnic background is Afro-Caribbean. And now I'm joined here today with Dr. Trezanne Kremer, the current director of the Institute of Criminal Justice and Security at the University of West Indies in Jamaica. She was previously the head of Good Offices for Peace and the lead political advisor to the Caribbean in the Commonwealth Secretariat, as well as interim head of office to the Commonwealth Deputy Secretary General. So hello, Dr. Kremer. Thank you so much for agreeing to meet with me today and feature on this segment of Grimshaw Speakers. How are you doing today? I know it's quite early where you are.
Thank you, Kenya, and thank you for inviting me to speak on this topic for your series. It is early morning, 9 o'clock here in a sunny Jamaica.
A big contrast to England right now. So yes, so this segment is in honor of Black History Month. We're taking this opportunity to explore international relations and the discipline and the field, but from the Black perspective with Dr. Kremer. So now with that in mind, I feel as if we can just jump straight into the questions. If that's okay?
Sure.
So to start, I would like to ask, how in your eyes has the discipline of international relations incorporated the perspective of the other? So this is, you know, the non-white or the non-European individual, if it has at all.
I think traditionally, international relations, looking at how nation states interact with each other, and how also civil society and citizens of states interact, traditionally has gone about this from a, I think, Western theoretical perspective, because of course there's an inherent power balance globally as to where influence lies. So even if you look at the structure of the United Nations in terms of the P5 countries and the other developing countries and the various blocs, the G77, etc., you can say that perhaps initially international relations was not necessarily geared to look at it from the space of non-white, per se, or non-Western countries. That has increasingly, I think, changed to the extent that you have other groupings that are developing to combat that. So even within the United Nations system, you have like the G77. Historically, you had things like the non-aligned movement, and you have different groupings also developing to kind of push back and force discussions about other perspectives in international relations, which is good.
No, I think that is a really great take on it. So it's great to hear that you've mentioned that there has definitely been some progression in terms of incorporating other perspectives and focusing on other groupings. So I guess just to add, what do you suppose can be done within the discipline to further the interrogation of the Black perspective or the perspective of the non-Western in international relations?
To a large extent, I think the scholarship also has to come from academics in telling their own story from the global South, mm-hmm. And from non-Western countries. And that is happening, but it is not divorced from real politics, where the power balance globally is not also in their favor. So it's the extent to which their scholarship is recognized and engaged with. So it is very important, I think, for academia, perhaps also in spaces such as LSE, the Cambridges and the Oxford to also ensure that they are engaging scholarship from this side of the world, from the Global South. To what extent are you familiar with the likes of the Walter Rodneys of this world and how they contributed to looking at how international relations is engaging with developing issues in their country? And so I think there is a responsibility for white universities to also improve and enhance how they engage with Global South practitioners and also scholars.
That's an excellent point, thank you. I think transitioning more so into the field and working in international relations, as a woman of color from the Caribbean, in a, let's quite be honest, a male and Western dominated field, I would imagine that you're not able to see, or you don't come across many people who resemble yourself, who resemble you either in senior positions and just generally within the field. So what motivated you as an individual to go into international relations, international affairs?
Well, I think it's probably something about what you're passionate about. And I don't necessarily think that international relations that I specifically sought it out. You know, it was just where I think my passion was. And that was particularly in regards to negotiation and mediation. It was something I was doing in another field, which I am now in criminology. And I started out looking at how nation states, the UK was renegotiating or trying to negotiate the repatriation of foreign national prisoners to the Global South, such as Jamaica and Nigeria. And that took me into negotiation and how that is done. But I also did international relations at university here in Jamaica before migrating. So I guess there was always that interest in that aspect of it. But international relations, I don't think should be seen as just something about diplomacy. Inherently, it is about how nation states are mobilizing themselves and interacting with each other for the benefit of their citizens. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is that platform internationally where the form of it is done through diplomacy and how states interact with each other. But there's a reason for that interaction, and that can be seen in the effects of people's lives on the ground and how that interaction that states do in their own interest benefits the lives of the persons who they are representing. So that, I think, is where you see the power imbalance of international relations. So those with more resources and more power and influence are perhaps better able or have more leverage in how they force positions, or they're able to make deals that are always perpetually in their interests, and leaving those countries who don't necessarily have that clout in a less advantageous position to how they can negotiate for the interests of their own citizens, which is why, you know, there are some states who hold certain ideological positions. They're always of interest in international relations because the impact of their decisions and how that is affecting their countries is always up for debate and discussion. And one of that is Cuba, you know, and for example, Venezuela, Russia. There are ways people may, in which the Western world may have views on how those countries do their international relations. Ideologically, those countries may have another view that because of the power imbalance, you know, they maintain a certain position, and yet still some of those citizens may say, well, you know, this benefits us in this way, but it is disadvantageous for us in another way. And international relations ultimately is a trade-off results in a trade-off of rights sometimes for how citizens experience that right, those rights. So I think that for that reason, those are the things that I think drew me to international relations, ultimately to see how you can influence countries' position so that it improves lives on the ground.
Lovely. I think that's a really great origin story for entering into international relations. And I think it's quite useful for, I guess, other young Black people to look to the people who they could be representing or resembling in the years to come. Because I'm sure, as you are quite aware, there is great disparity within the, first of all, number of Black students in higher education. And then even more so, there's a greater disparity between the Black students who go to study the likes of politics and international relations in comparison to medicine or economics. And I mean, I guess from my understanding, I believe that it's probably due to cultural stigmas of the profession in politics, like in the Caribbean or Africa. But I was wondering if you had any other estimations as to why there are probably less of us studying politics and international relations.
And I perhaps, you know, you probably speak, of course, from the UK perspective, which I'm somewhat familiar with. Of course, that's not the case elsewhere where, you know, most of our population here is Black. But it perhaps has to do with representation and how persons perhaps see them being able to make an impact if they enter a particular field. And if that representation is not clear to them, then the attractiveness of the discipline may not be there. And if they don't have, as you have just said, role models that can demonstrate to them that this is possible and you are able to make a difference when you enter that discipline, it's difficult for them to see, I guess, how successful they could be and why they should consider it as a viable place to make their livelihood. I'm, for example, within the UK political system, as representatives, I'm not, you know, you don't necessarily, I don't think, have a lot of Black or minority individuals representative there. Mm-hmm. And that's your avenue for that representation of diplomacy, at least, you know, on that stage. But there is also the field of international development. And perhaps traditionally, you know, the average minority student in the United Kingdom may not see that representation as perhaps we would see it here in Jamaica or someone in Africa would see that. And I tell you why. Yeah, on the field, the development aid is probably seen more like a reciprocal endeavor, where Western countries are providing aid in a particular way to certain countries. So if you go, for example, to a United Nations mission in somewhere in Nigeria or Kenya or in Jamaica, you are probably likely to see representations of Black persons in senior positions. And the young people working and living in those countries will perhaps also see that on the ground where they come into contact with it. But you don't have that representation visible to United Kingdom minority students because you may need aid, I don't know, but you certainly, it's not there obviously on the ground to you like that. Perhaps where it is more obvious is perhaps like in things like social services and how that is met out. And that perhaps is not an attractive field enough for minority and Black persons to see how developmental aid is a successful career path.
Definitely.
That way.
No, thank you.
Or high flying career path. No. Definitely successful, but how they may view that as, you know, whether it is a very senior or prestigious career is another matter.
then I guess that's a reason as to why podcasts and situations, circumstances like this are so important. It's an opportunity for young people and other people to see that this is a career path that a lot of people can flourish in and do so well in and make a lot of important and meaningful impact in. So I guess on that note, do you have any advice for any young Black women and young minority students in general who are listening to this podcast and are, you know, greatly inspired by how your career has progressed and would also like to follow in your footsteps?
Advice. One, I would advise to always be authentic to yourself. And people see careers like this sometimes as something because you're also making representation where you have to follow a particular mold. I've never been interested nor drawn to that advice. I've always thought that in order to make an impact in the international space, you ought to be your authentic self, because in this space, it is also about relationship building. And you do that by enabling trust with the interlocutors that you meet. People know when you're not being authentic. And I think you make much more progress when you present yourself as you are. It also then means that you have to know what it is that you are presenting and be respectful of others' culture, of others' positions and space. You also have to always make an interest to understand the other, exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So you may have your own perceptions as to what should be, but an important role of being an international relations expert and practitioner is understanding what drives interests. What are the interests of particular positions and parties? You are only able to do that if you can reasonably compartmentalize your own prejudices to understand the interests and positions of others so that you can engage with it. And that is where your authenticity, and I think how empathetic you are in your leadership and your representation, is very important. Sometimes people, I think that IR is a tough field and it's just all about realism. Ultimately, you're here to make a difference in people's lives. And sometimes, yes, you are there to represent your own country's interests, etc. But in my view, it's always best to take note of the other person's position. That's the best way, I think it is, to advance your own. To know exactly what their interests are, what drives them, and what their needs are. Secondly, I would suggest that it is important to engage with other cultures in a meaningful way. And sometimes that may mean learning another language. I think that's one weakness that I didn't have, that I didn't do. And perhaps that's because of also my learning position coming from the Global South. It wasn't an option available to me readily to study another language. That's available to most minority persons in the UK, and I would advise them to take advantage of it if it's there. Thirdly, and particularly for young Black women, is to ensure that you hold your position meaningfully and state your cases always with respect, but I think never letting others question your positions, your intelligence, without you also questioning the reasoning behind that doubt. Why I'm saying that, it's very important for you to believe in yourself and the expertise that you bring to the table, even if you are the only one there. And if you're the only one there who looks the way you look, sometimes there is a tendency for others to question the value of the thought that you bring. And if you are confident in yourself and the expertise and the thought that you bring to the table, I don't think that you should allow anyone to allow you to doubt the expertise that you're bringing to that table. And there are ways in which you can ensure that you encourage others to respect your own opinion that you have at the table.
Thank you. I think that was very insightful. I think speaking on behalf of a lot of minority students at LSE, or the minority students at LSE, there is a general feeling of imposter syndrome that I think is greatly emphasized by being the only one of a certain ethnicity in the classroom. So I think that was a really insightful thing to add. Thank you. I guess in
it's important. Interesting you say that. One of the things that became immediately clear to me when I just started in this field was coming from Jamaica, it was never an issue for me to ask challenging questions and to be challenged. It is how I sought knowledge, and it was how I was encouraged at the University of the West Indies, where I was, you know, schooled in my undergraduate degree, to challenge, to learn. That is how you learn. But I realized that when I entered international relations space internationally and in the United Kingdom, it was seen as something very rare, that, you know, you are supposed to understand your position, you listen to others, and perhaps the British culture to perhaps, you know, the stiff upper lip. And so when you find a confident Black woman from Jamaica asking questions of seniors, or also, you know, asking and challenging certain held views, it was rare for others to appreciate. And I think that's the place I'm coming from when I say, if you're confident in your own expertise and thought, even if others are not used to that representation, I don't think you should dim your own space and light.
Thank you. I hope everybody was listening to that that snippet of advice. I think, in continuation on talking about challenging experiences, if you're able to, would you please be able to describe one of your most, or a challenging experience that you've had to deal with working as a Black professional in this field, and how you may have addressed the situation at the time? If you're
I guess there are many, but I think perhaps, since we're talking about this, in terms of the actual work in the field, sometimes, you know, I've worked with prime ministers, presidents, and sometimes they themselves are surprised when they see a young, or what looks to be young to them, a young Black woman talking to them in that senior space.
Oh, yeah.
And about senior and very substantive issues that traditionally they would have expected, you know, someone at least who looks much older to do. But I find that once persons are confident, they realize that you are an expert in your field, you show respect for them, that is usually overcome. It's not usually an issue, but they'll certainly comment that they're impressed that you are able to engage with them on substantive issues, considering your age, madam. I'm sure you're not much older than XXY. And to that, you usually find a nice comment and move along. Yeah? So that's how you deal with that in the field. I don't necessarily think that's a challenge per se. I think the challenge is more perhaps internally, in the managerial space, and how you navigate that, where there are expectations of how you should act, how you should behave. And I think that is where perhaps young Black persons could probably find mentors, and also ensure that they are keeping abreast of developments. But mentorship would be very important to guide, I think, young Black persons through some of those operational managerial challenges that you will find as you climb the professional ladder.
Thank you. Yes, I think the mentor point is especially useful in the field of international relations, and just in a field where, as you said, there is people tend to not see many people who look like them. So having that constant, or you know, that momentary reassurance of, I have this person here who I can relay my day to and say, is this a normal experience, or how did you react in this instance when you were also faced with these challenges? I think that's a very excellent point. I want to just quickly slide back to focusing more on working in international relations, but from the perspective of a small state, and going back to the small state narrative. If you can make any distinctions between you know, working working within the domain of the Caribbean, and then working within international organizations or intergovernmental organizations, are you able to highlight any like distinct differences in the way that representing Jamaica or representing yourself as an individual, have you noticed any large distinctions between how you were treated?
There are some, and some are positive. Okay. And I guess that has to do with also the positive side. Usually, I found out pretty quickly that when I engaged internationally as a Jamaican, I was respected because of the fact that I'm Jamaican. That was something that I was proud of, but it also showed me that that's an advantage I had. And I utilize that sometimes to gain access to spaces and also for conversations. I guess because of our culture, Jamaica is known and respected for music or athletes. And it just has a vibrant culture that when you say you're from Jamaica, suddenly there is usually a discussion from the interlocutor about, oh, I like your country for X reason, I like you. And that is always a good thing to build a relationship and start conversation. So at the micro level, that has been good for me. At the macro level, small states have inherent difficulties in engaging. One, because they do not have that power leverage that others, that perhaps, you know, single Western countries have. And so they have to, or they should, act together more as collective groupings. And that is increasingly difficult within the global, international global space. So for example, the Caribbean, a group of small states, they act together as CARICOM, the Caribbean community. And similarly in the Pacific, the small states, they act together through the Pacific Island states. They have different challenges. They have climate change issues. They have high unemployment issues. In terms of climate change, many of them are looking at the possibility of not being in existence in years to come. There's also natural disasters that they're plagued with here in the Caribbean right now. We're in the middle of the hurricane season. So, you know, you grow up looking at the weather every morning, because I'm looking at the systems that's forming coming over from Africa, because you can have a hurricane at any time, particularly during this season. And that is the nature of life. So they don't have the luxury of taking singular positions. They usually have to act as a grouping together. But it's easy for divisions to happen. And because of their developmental needs, that togetherness is not normally held, because Western countries and others can pick that apart very quickly with bilateral interests and discussions happening that each state would want to secure for themselves. So it's a very difficult position for small states in the international scene. However, groupings such as the Commonwealth and others, ALBA, you have the ECLAC community, allows them to come together on various thematic issues to form positions and alliances and to try and navigate their way through some of the challenges facing the global community. But they certainly don't have, one, the resources and the political leverage in order to take certain positions as, you know, certain Western position, countries would, because they rely also so much on development aid and support from Western countries being highly indebted as they are.
Thank you. No, I think that's a great point to mention, because well, within international relations, there's the saying that small states don't matter. And I think as much as within the discipline, you know, there have been theories which have been created to combat this and to critique this narrative, unfortunately, it's still a perspective of the global South and the non-West that is very apparent today with how we theorize and just, I guess, deal with smaller states. So I think being able to highlight, first of all, the reasons as to why this connotation of small states not mattering still exists, and highlighting the reasons being, you know, great power imbalances and the reasons for why these small states must or work better together in these groupings is very important. Because unfortunately, even at LSE, it's a great university, and we do spend some time looking at smaller states. We don't have the opportunity to delve into the specific reasons as to why some smaller states work better in some groupings and partnerships in comparison to others. And maybe the remnants of colonial power and coercion that still exists in the government, so domestically, but also influencing how the country acts in its international region. So thank you very much for this. So thank you, Dr. Kremer. We have also reached the end of our podcast segment today, but I really do appreciate you taking the time to speak to us about your perspective on international relations. I do hope you've had a lovely time as well. It's been a great experience for me individually, and I've also learned a lot, so thank you.
Thank you, Kenya. It was my pleasure. Great talking to you, and all the best to you and to your colleagues at LSE. And I want to encourage you and your interest in international relations going forward. I'm sure you do well at it, and we need more. We need more Black young persons to enter the field and claim your space and make your voice heard.
Many thanks to our speaker, Dr. Trezanne Kremer. We hope you enjoyed this episode. The music for this podcast was produced by Ash Lyomassen. For more information on Beba Sound and the Grimshaw Club, check out our website and social media.